You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the show. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today we are talking to Mawan Rizwan. Now, you might know Mawan from his stand-up, which led to his hit BBC show Juice, that's still available on iPlayer, and it's brilliant. You might know him from his viral hits he was doing, I mean, as we will talk about on this episode. He was doing YouTube videos and making YouTube video series when he was like a teenager, 14 years ago. You will almost certainly know him from his unforgettable appearance on Taskmaster. And it's been a joy. It's been a long-term goal to get him on the show. We've been talking about it for ages. I know that he's listened to the show before. And I was so pleased that we actually managed to meet in person. We videoed it. You can get the full video episode of this one on by joining the Insiders Club. And in the first half of this episode, we're going to discuss Mawan's childhood, where failure was not an option. We're going to discuss him directing grime videos with Big Nasty. And we're going to discuss what it means to grow up in a world, in a landscape of content creation, not just of comedy. Now, the big news is that you can join the new and improved Insiders Club via Patreon at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. I will tell you more about this in the middle of the show and after the show, but you can watch this full episode and get access to over 20 minutes of bonus features, including we're going to talk to Mawan about getting to the final two of an audition process for a life-changing role and harnessing pirate energy in an industry full of university-educated people. I'm going to tell you more about the all-new Insiders Club in a bit, but for now, here is Mawan Rizwan. Now, something I remember you said in when you were on the Graham Norton show, you talked about your mum and how she'd said to you, like, I can't remember exactly what you said. It was a beautiful thing. The nature of it, I think, was like, whatever you do, don't be boring.
Yeah, like, be terrible, don't be boring.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about your relationship with your mum. Let's talk about where that kind of started. Because the last thing I was doing last night, I've been watching loads of Juice. I've been watching loads of your clips and listening to your songs on Spotify, which are kind of like, it's really funny listening to like the Spotify version of a song and visualizing you as you walk around the street. but one of the things I looked at last night was like your early YouTube stuff. Yeah. I had no idea how young you were. I'm not saying you look old, but you're so in control.
I'm getting on. Yeah. I'm getting on.
I had no idea. You were a YouTuber like when you were 14. And there's you and your brother. Like the very first video you put up is you and your brother freestyle rapping.
Yeah.
And it's good, man.
What? Like
it's not good freestyle rapping, but I could look at you and go, well, that's a star. Do you know what I mean? That kid is so, oh, come on. That kid, I don't know if you're like 14 or something at the time, you are so 15? Kind of handsome and lively and sparkly and confident. Like, I'm sure a lot of 14, 15-year-olds made a load of YouTube videos and they're dog shit. But you're just like, I'm absolutely ready for my own thing.
Oh, wow. I see it as like a kid who was so desperate for attention and got into performing for all the wrong reasons. You know, like over the years, I've learned that like you need to do it for the right reasons. But starting out, it was very much like it got me a clap, and I just saw I wanted to do more of it. And you know, every now and again in drama, the teacher would be like, "Oh yeah, you're good. You're good. Or that's good when you do that." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm not shit. I'm not like, oh, maybe I'm accepted in this world, right?" So that's why I got a camera, because my brother was really funny and I just found him really funny and he was really goofy and clowny and I wanted to record him, but he became too cool for school, so I had to start being in him.
Got it. Lots to unpack there. I think one of the things about it is how
kind you are to your brother. Like, he's your little brother, is that right? Or is he big brother?
Little brother, little 5 brother. Years younger. Oh, really? That's... Yeah. I don't think I'm kind of tall. I'm trying to get more camera time.
Yes, but given that it's a project that that a kid is doing with his little brother, you're quite, like, you're doing quite good, kind of, you're letting him take...
Do you reckon?
You know what I mean? Yeah, for sure. It's definitely your thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
but
you're
not just, he's not just the sidekick, you're giving him space. I was like, this is some really great instincts there, Mama. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're being kind to him, and you're sort of, like, you're egging him on, and then, like, you cut him off, but in a warm kind of a way.
Wow, man, you really read into this. You've done some, like, Secret Life of 5-Year-Olds kind of obdoc on this. I love it. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think there's a lot going on in those videos. There's also a lot of pain in those videos. I actually can't watch them back because I leave them up so people know that it's been a long journey, right? Because, you know, you're not born a superstar like I am now. It takes a lot of work. Like, that's, like, 14 years of, like, figuring shit out and making really bad things often, you know? So, yeah, I definitely see it as, like... Yeah, no, I don't know. I forgot what I was saying.
It's one of those things, I think, where when I watched those, I felt like, oh, this is the roadmap. I remember doing like a talk to students in my old drama college years and years ago. And I think I was really hard on them. I think my whole talk was like, there's no money out there. And there's no work. Learn to be plumbers as well, and then you'll be happy. Do you know what I mean? It was like, it was, and afterwards, I think the bloke who booked me was my old drama teacher. He was like, you were pretty tough on them. I was like, oh, I maybe this is coming from not a great place in my life at the time.
Yeah.
But one of the things I remember saying to them was like, look, if you're serious about, they were actors. I said, if you're serious about being an actor, YouTube is out there. Video yourself acting. Like, there's almost no need to be here. Just make stuff, learn how the stuff is. So I think a lot of people who want to be actors or who want to be famous are in love with the idea of it. I certainly was. I loved the idea of being an actor. I didn't want to actually turn up and be an actor. I just was like starry-eyed, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think what I was sort of saying to them to do was kind of pretty much what you did, which is, I would recommend to any young person now, any teenager who's like, oh, I want to be famous, I want to do stuff. I'd really recommend going back and watching some of those early videos of yours, because you go, okay, this is a person figuring it out, working out what works for them. You know, the production values gradually increase. Mm-hmm. Even when it comes to, and I don't know how many years later this was, but the Moan show, which was a completely, I mean, what do I know about commissioning? But, you know, there was like little 6-minute sections that had production values, really funny ideas. That thing where you've got your mate against the green screen background and you're trying to get him to go, no, do something weird for the show, and he just can't think of anything weird. It's a completely solid premise with a completely solid sketch, production values, editing, the lot. Mm-hmm. So to watch your kind of creative development, I think, through those is fascinating. It's one of those things that would make me say, oh, are you in, like, to a younger person, go back and look at this, because this is someone who this has just turned into a long rant about how great you are.
I love it.
There's not really a question in here. But I just wonder, when you said you got into it for the wrong reasons, it doesn't look, you don't see a kid who's got into it for the wrong reasons. Maybe there's a bit of bright-eyed enthusiasm about getting clapped at, you know.
Maybe I have a cynical take on it, because it's like, I think a lot of those videos and early days creativity was a coping mechanism, escapism from, like, quite intense life shit. Also, a family, there's a lot going on financially, and, like, it was difficult. And I used to film my parents, and it was a way of being like, oh, they're funny. That was the only time I really actually liked my parents, especially my mom. She was so hard on us. And when she did the videos, there was this weird contradiction in her where she was like, on one side, she was so like, you know, you need to be the best. If you're ever going to do anything, you need to be the best. Otherwise, all my sacrifices have gone to waste. And she was like, education. Otherwise, I've come to this country for nothing. And then we'd do the music videos, the videos, and she was just really funny and entertaining. And I was like, well, if my parents are funny, then maybe everything's going to be all right. So there's a lot of, like, icky pain, coping mechanism stuff going on, as well as a kid who maybe just wanted to be famous, as well as a kid who's going, oh, no, this is, editing is a skill. Oh, performing is a skill. Oh, knowing to keep yourself in focus and hit your mark. And, oh, there's a thing called a film set, and actually it's like a military operation, and actually I need to get work on a film set to understand how different roles work and maybe which sector of the film industry I could work in.
Yeah.
So it's a very slow process, and it's all the stuff at the same time.
There's a line in Juice where your mum, it's in the third episode, I think, when you're almost having like a roast battle in the restaurant.
Mm.
And there's a line where you say to your mum, listen, you've always, you know, you haven't achieved all this stuff you say you've achieved. And she says, I was the first girl in my village to ride a bicycle. I was crying laughing at that because I think that really encapsulates part of her character. Now, obviously, that's not your, it is played by your real mum, but she's saying the words that you've written for her.
Mm-hmm.
That is an incredibly dense relationship that you've described there of like, she drove me really, really hard. She wanted to be a star. Was she like a child actor mm-hmm. initially?
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to be a star. She made, like, presumably she felt she gave up performing in order to come here. Was that part of the dynamic of it?
Yeah, and other stuff as well, and personal stuff. And, that whole thing of that martyrdom that parents do. Especially parents who migrate, of like, I gave up my dreams so that you could have some.
Yeah.
So you could have a better life.
And you've ended up,
little nutshell,
in this extraordinarily unusual situation of having launched your mum and your brother, and now perhaps your dad to some extent, into some kind of, you know, entertainment career. Like, I don't know, did you launch your brother into it? Or was he, like, I mean, no, he got famous. Was that...
I would like to say yes, I did, and I would take full credit. But he probably didn't. It probably wasn't. He was figuring stuff out, and he basically did what I did in terms of, like, did loads of free courses, tried to figure stuff out. He was, like, doing spoken word and, you know, rapping and... He was always creating anyway. I think the YouTube videos were made it like a thing that we did. So we kind of made an identity out of it. So maybe that made it easier for him.
Yeah.
But whenever people ask, I was like, yeah, I launched him. Because it's just easier, isn't it, to say that.
It's funny because from the outside, it seems so kind of generous and warm and celebratory that you're like, hey, you've done stand-up about it where you talk about how gutted I am that, you know, if you mm-hmm. search my name, the auto-completes, my mum is on mum and mum is on dad.
That was true for a while.
For a while. Okay, we've got that in, not anymore.
Yeah. And then I got successful and it was fine. That was a really good motivator, actually, to keep...
I mean, what...
being more successful.
What a motivator to, like, because like I said, from the outside, it seems so warm and generous and celebratory, but I think what you're kind of hinting at is there's other kind of icky stuff under there as well about, like, it can't have been easy having a mum that was so driven. Like, that is a good principle in many ways. It's like a kind of Ken Campbell, you know, be heroic, don't you dare be boring, like, be terrible, but don't be boring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's sort of like you'd expect that from like a teacher at a military clown academy. Do you know what I mean? It's like your mum has a sort of Goliath quality to her, do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, this is shit, be better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that feel? What's your emotional reaction to that? Anytime I've done those kind of, I've never been to Goliath, but that kind of, you're doing clowning and the teacher is showing you that you're not funny by going meow in front of you and everyone. Mm-hmm. Brutal kind of clowning training.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very bruised and very damaged by that. And I didn't necessarily, I had little flashes of discovery.
Yeah.
I didn't then go, this has unlocked a positive thing.
Right. No, I really responded to it. I was like, mum?
Yeah, you must have.
Oh, this feels like home. Yeah, no, I think growing up it was quite hard because the stakes were really high.
What were the stakes?
The stakes were like, you know, so like we got a deportation letter at one point and she really used that as a way of being like, look, you know, she was doing three jobs to fight for the legal battle, to pay for the legal battles to fight it. And she was doing a lot. She was like working like round the clock and teaching us. And then she also would get neighborhood kids, immigrant kids, and teach them English, math, science after school so that we could learn more after school. So we'd come home from school and then we'd have 2 hours of tuition, which felt...
Tuition from her?
From her.
Okay.
And there'd always be like 15 kids around the table, you know, in our living room. And so it was like home was sometimes more school than school.
Mm.
And so there was kind of... The reasons why stakes felt high also because she had a reputation to uphold. She was like the teacher, like she wanted us to get into grammar school. She was teaching 11 plus to the neighborhood kids. She taught kids who then got in and passed that exam and got a scholarship to grammar school. None of us did. And that was a real shaming thing for her because she was like, I'm the teacher. Like she was always a sort of community leader type figure.
Okay.
And with that came, you are my examples of how you can... And sometimes I reckon it was ego related and sometimes it was selfish. But a lot of the times it was because she really just wanted us to do well. And she saw just failure just wasn't an option.
That's, I think you've said that twice now in this, like failure not being an option. I think I'm interested in like that would kind of cook any comic, right? As a kid, that would help forge a comic. Like even without the kind of the entertainment focus of what she was, you know, her like childhood star, you know, be interesting, that kind of stuff. Even without any of that, loads and loads and loads of pressure from a parent. You've got to succeed. You've got to make my sacrifices worthwhile. That might kind of, you'd imagine that would push a young boy or a teenage boy into running away with entertainment. But the thing you were running away into was also wrapped up in her and her expectations for you. So did you feel like you were rebelling by being a performer, or did you feel like you were conforming to her wishes by being a performer?
Whoa. No, I felt like I was rebelling. Like, I did feel like I was following my own.
Okay.
Because I also used it as a way to like get away from them. It's really weird. It's a really weird contradictory relationship, because I got her involved in the videos because it was also a lighthearted relief from all the stuff going on. But at the same time, it was just aligned with, you know, there was also a lot of love from her, and a lot of like, she was such a good example of someone who like was like going through shit, but also somehow managed to prioritize art and creativity. So she's very unpredictable person in that way, you know, and she has contradictions, which I think has helped in terms of me making stuff.
What was the first bit of, like, other than the videos you did, what was the first kind of mainstream thing that referred to her? Was it like material about her on stage, or was it putting her in a video? I'm just interested in, like, I'm asking because I want to kind of get at whether she's sort of satisfied now with your, presumably she's satisfied with your success.
Yeah, although part of me still thinks she doesn't quite understand.
Oh, that's what I'm worried
about. Yeah, yeah.
What's that feel? What part of you feels that she's what? You part of you worries that she's not, like, she doesn't get it, or she doesn't get the.
No, I like that she doesn't get it. I like that she's like.
So that bit's rebelling because you're excelling at something that she doesn't quite get.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. But also, I'm doing it on my own terms, and so the first day we turned up to the shoot for Juice, me and my brother and my mum, we all had trailers next to each other. And we just remember like turning up at 5 a.m. on that first day of the shoot, just being like, what the fuck? Like, just have trailers next to each other. And we just all looked at each other like, this is mad, and where we've come from. It was quite emotional. And those moments are like, no, she totally gets it. And she understands. You could feel the emotion, like, without, we weren't even saying anything, but that whole shoot was just like, I can't believe they let us get away with it. And also, we deserve to be here because we've worked our asses off. And also, who'd have thunk it, against all odds? It was just so blissful. And then also, I'll go to the BAFTAs or whatever. She'll be like, yeah, good for you, whatever. Like, she doesn't, so I like that she partly doesn't get it, because it kind of, I don't get carried away with the weird industry stuff.
Okay.
Because it's not like I'm doing that to get her validation anymore.
Yes, yes, okay.
Because she kind of doesn't get that. So I'm just doing my own thing.
So you can't validate it. So it actually means you're free to go to the BAFTAs without thinking mum would be pleased.
Yeah. No, literally isn't watching, doesn't care. which is amazing, and it's freeing, because our industry is a bit bullshit. And it's nice when actually the people close to you are a bit detached from all the ego structures of it.
Yes. Yeah. You were saying before, in terms of your, like, how hard you find writing on your own, that you feed off other people, like other people's kind of energy and creativity, I guess, and stuff like that. Is she someone that you feed off? Are your family members someone that you feed off?
Out of necessity, they were the only ones around. And actually, I used to put a lot of my friends in it, and I used to get my, you know, I used to direct music videos for grime artists. That was like my first bit of like, I'm going to make films in the world.
Okay.
And I used to like turn up, I was like 18 years old, I used to like copy and paste the contract off Google and like turn up into McDonald's, and it'd be like someone from like Big Nasty's crew just like sitting there like being like, yeah, but I need sexy girls, yeah, sexy girls. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I try and get my sexiest friends to be in there.
God.
And then my mum would do their makeup and my dad would do the catering. And,
that's unreal.
Yeah. And all my friends would just come in and work for free. Yeah, it was incredible.
And this is part of what you sort of described as, it sounds like it's a kind of methodical approach to, And one of the things I noticed, I think I asked you to be on the podcast like 5 years ago and you sort of said, I'm not ready yet. And I sort of went, what do you mean? But you seem to have like a real...
I don't remember that.
I think you said that. But you might have just been palming me off because you're busy. That's entirely reasonable. But it seems like a very methodical approach to how can I get to the thing? I'll need to spend time on film sets. I'll need to direct stuff. So you kind of built... You went to Golio, right?
Mm.
So how long were you there for?
I could only afford the summer course.
Okay. So yeah. Was that like a kind of deliberate, methodical piece of the puzzle? In the way that, like, I think a lot of people, maybe actors or something, or stand-ups who are frustrated, go and study with the great French clown teacher, Golier, in order to sort of unlock something for them.
Mm.
It feels more like, I suppose, I don't know to what extent I'm sort of contriving this myself, but my assumption has always been it's like, I must go there to unlock myself and find out who I am. With you, I wonder, was it more sort of like, I'm going to need that piece of the puzzle as well?
Oh, no, I never had a five-year plan or whatever. I just remember...
How did you not have a five-year plan?
No, I didn't. I had dreams, like big ones. And then
you methodically approached assembling all of the pieces of those dreams.
Sure. But like, you know, I never went to university. I never trained, apart from that Golia summer course. So I always just saw it as my duty, as my proactive duty of someone who wants to make art in the world. I was like, I'm going to come up with my own curriculum and I'm going to... I see someone who I was blown away by or I admired. Actually, listening to this podcast, it was Dr. Brown on it. Talking about Golier, and I went to see a show, and I was like, "That whatever it is that needs to be part of the puzzle." So then I do go off and do that. But then to do that, you're like, you know, okay, but I'm going to do that job, so I get the money for it. Then I'm going to do that. So there was a bit of methodical around, and then I'm going to book myself in Edinburgh, so I get to apply what I've learned straight away. And so there is that kind of year long methodical stuff.
Yes,
but it's mainly just taken on too much. You know, I've done like 12 years of just doing too much and a lot of it is stuck and a lot of it hasn't, but you just don't see the stuff that hasn't.
When you talk about that Dr. Brown thing, seeing that that's part of the puzzle, can you articulate what bit of that was that you were responding to?
Oh, the pirate energy he had at his show and just the...
What do you mean pirate energy?
You know, like it was wrong and he was breaking rules and he was so naughty. I wanted to be naughty. I wanted to be in a room and people just be like, oh, he's crazy. He just takes us for a ride. And you just grab people and you just go. And I wanted that energy, whether it was in my scripts or in my performance. I wanted the rebellious, naughty energy that I didn't have at that stage. I remember doing quite fairly bog standard stand-up premises. And up until that point, I was maybe doing my impression of stand-up comedians that I've seen that are quite... you know, normative.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just in terms of the naughtiness, I'm remembering now some of the early YouTube videos. You did a thing with a guy called Ollie White, who I believe went on to become a massive YouTuber.
Yeah.
Where you were just kind of being annoying on tubes.
Yeah.
And it's really funny because it's from a long time ago, but it's like, oh, everyone's doing that on TikTok now. It's that kind of, oh, if we create a YouTube and we kind of democratize everyone having a video camera, teenagers will be annoying in public. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And part of me, like, when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's a curious sort of understandable step along the way. And then initially I was like, oh, you're really, these are stooges. And then I was like, no, you're really annoying real people.
Really annoying,
But part of me almost, there are elements of it where, like, I don't love that genre particularly, but there were elements of it that were very funny. There's, like, someone asleep on the tube and you fall asleep on them and your mates asleep on their feet. And it did have a kind of completeness. It had a sort of there was a worthwhile joke to it.
Yeah, they were excruciating to shoot though, man. But I remember just being like, you have to be audacious and ignore the people in that moment. And then it will always be funny in the video. The more you don't give a shit about the real life people.
Where did that rule come from?
I just remember filming one and being like, it's too tamed. I didn't push myself enough.
Yes.
And that's the thing with the YouTube videos. You'd always watch it back and you'd be like, could have done that better. And you're then editing it and being like, I don't have this shot that I need. So the next time you get out, you're just like, well, fuck it. I need to get it.
You've got to end. You're thinking about you in the editing room going, I've got to have the shot.
Exactly. And you're thinking about the comment that people will be like, where they'll say the time code number.
Yeah.
Or like, oh my God, this bit is nuts. And the one that they'll share. And you're thinking about all that stuff.
God, as a teenager.
Yeah, mad.
Those are like, you've really grown up inside the world of, I tell our men, I was going to say content creation. What I mean is all the stuff you do, you know, all the stuff we're talking about, you've grown up inside the world of it.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to do it to be like, nah, not for me. Or, you know, some of that stuff, it definitely taught me things, but I definitely didn't want to do that for a very long time. I was like, oh, I'm just going to become an annoying prankster YouTube person. That can only go so far. And it's not that fulfilling.
Well, it's interesting. When I started looking into it, and I was going, oh, right. Oh, he used to be a YouTuber. I didn't know that. And I went back and I kind of looked at your YouTube channel, which has a healthy number of subscribers, but not necessarily what you'd expect from someone who started. It's not like Mr. Beast numbers from someone who started as a teenager. And I thought, yeah. Oh, you dropped this and moved on. And so I clicked on Ollie, is it Ollie White? Is that his name? And he's on like 3 million subscribers or something. And I'm going, oh, right, that's one of the paths you decided not to take.
Well, I also pissed a lot of my audience off. So like I would find a thing and then break it because I was using, in the way I used Edinburgh, I was using it as a, let's see what sticks, let's grow artistically. And let's try pranks. Nah, not for me. Let's try a magazine show. Okay, yeah, there's bits of this I like. Let's try something really surreal. You know, and I think a lot of people are just like, who are you? Like, why don't you just do those videos about Asian mums anymore?
It's like, yes, because actually what the algorithm wants is one joke said in lots of different ways.
Exactly.
I mean, not, yeah, you know, that's very reductive, but no, I think that's what you were rejecting.
Yeah, and it's a really good training because YouTube and that thing is really simplified representation of the greater industry, I think. Because the greater industry wants the same thing as well. You do your thing, you do your Netflix special, you have your brand and you have your, and then you just kind of keep doing it and, in terms of monetizing, and then it eventually gets to bigger venues and stuff. Like, it is just, that is just how it works.
Because if someone's producing you, they want you to cultivate the same audience and the same people and sell them tickets for £10, then tickets for £15, then bigger venue for £40. Do you know what I mean? And that, yeah, you're absolutely right. That behaves in the same way. So to resist that, did that feel hard work to resist it? Because presumably when you do a thing that works, you get all the dopamine from, oh, loads of people click like.
Yeah.
They liked it. And then you've presumably got to have a bit of intestinal fortitude to go, I'm going to not do that. Because, and I'm going to start again doing something different with 5 likes.
Yeah, but it's because I'd see people fucking shit up. And I was like, that's a way more interesting way to live your life. And I'm really lucky, actually, because I always really wanted, I wanted those millions. I wanted those subscribers. I wanted them so bad. And I'm really glad I never really got mass attention. Even now with Juice, like, I'm really glad that it's not the show overnight. Everyone is going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, there's a really good buzz to it, but it's very much first series. You know, maybe by third series it will catch. But, like, there is something so valuable about not being the biggest thing since sliced bread or not blowing up with a project. Always just kind of simmering away because at any point you could be like, nah, prioritize my artistic choice. Rather than commercial game, because the pressure is higher to conform when there's more eyes on you and when there's more commercial eyes on you.
That's so smart. That's
and really YouTube good. Taught me that. YouTube was like the perfect pre-training before getting into the bigger arena of all those things, of how to deal with hate, of how to like understand the difference between just wanting attention and wanting to be good at an art form.
Yes, recognizing that popular doesn't mean good.
Yeah.
Like actually learning that and knowing it in the bone.
Yeah, and pissing people off. Always piss people off. Like I remember when I did the Moan show, like I lost a lot of my subscribers. So you do all these like 5, 6, 7, 8 years of like building momentum and then you see your subscriber list just drop.
No one ever talks about that. Yeah. I don't think anyone's ever mentioned that. Everyone likes to give the impression that it's relentless growth. Of course, naturally, you know, people listen to the show. I want people to be vulnerable and admit the stuff. But yeah, those drop-off moments where you go explosive something and then they dribble away.
And I'll do that in my career in terms of like, I might do a movie that's like just like the subscriber count, metaphorically. People just go, oh no, he fell off. He's not good at it. It's not Juice, is it? Like, yeah, he's not as good as he used to be or whatever. Do you know what I mean? And no, that was me experimenting and whatever. Sometimes it bangs, sometimes it doesn't.
What voice is that of like being able to, I suppose what I'm asking is for someone as driven as you, for someone as kind of driven and that kind of, that drive maybe being forged in the crucible of your upbringing and your the influence of your mum, for someone as driven, like that seems so... not counterintuitive, but it seems like what a lucky escape to be so driven, but not so driven that you have to just pursue whatever works.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I mean? That's a, mm-hmm. that's a real contradiction. So that, where does that voice come from? Like, is that, do you feel that's like a really healthy internal voice that's saying, no, mate, we haven't got to do this?
That internal voice comes from like filling up the well and with like inspiration of people, like watching stuff, reading stuff, keeping an eye on the people who've done it the way I enjoy. Like every now and again, I'll be like, well, Donald Glover's not done a thing in a couple of years. And he's probably just cultivating his next project. Or he did that and then dropped a music album no one expected. Like, it's okay. You know, the ones who, I don't know, just the interesting shit is the stuff that catches you. I don't know, just, I think basically seeing other people who are like, who I idolize helps. And they're often, there's just a pattern in the people I'm inspired by, and they're rebellious and unpredictable.
And who, can you give me some other examples? Donald Glover's a great example of that.
Yeah, he's like, I love what he's done. You know, Michaela Cole.
Yeah.
Who else? Also, like, a lot of musicians and MIA.
Yeah.
You know, she's a complete pirate. I love that energy.
Yeah, that documentary was incredible.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Mad. I went to see it 4 times.
her basic assumptions about what her role is, I think, are really fascinating.
Yes.
I can see why that kind of, why that appeals to you. That thing of like, as soon as this works, do something else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Break the mandala, start again. And also, I'm doing that. I'm taking the scenic road, man. I'm like, I know I'm going to be doing this to my dying breath, right? So what's the rush? Also, people like, I remember being that consumer of commercial stuff and being really reductive about artists. You know, I'd remember, you know, you see like Riz Ahmed and you're like, oh, well, he hasn't done anything in 6 years now. Like, nothing that's really, really hit commercial, whatever. And then he comes out with the most amazing stuff and you go, oh, the true people, the people who really are doing this for the love of the art form, they come and go in a really healthy way and they're doing it on their own terms. Yeah.
Do you feel as consistent as this consistently? I'll explain what I mean by that very confusing question. I'm so in awe of your kind of MO, of how you've done this and the things that appeal to you. You've decided what's important to you, the rebelliousness, the naughtiness, changing it up all the time. Like, I think we've all got our own sort of set of precepts. We've all got our set of, I don't know what that word means. It just felt right in the same, mm-hmm. in the right sentence. I think we've all got our set of principles, mm-hmm. as to I'm going to be like this and I'm going to do this. With mine, and maybe it's partly a result of doing, like, talking to hundreds and hundreds of comics about theirs and always leaving. I always think when I watched Back to the Future when I was a kid, I was like, I want a skateboard. And then I watched Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I was like, I want to throw knives. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I get sort of overwhelmed by individual little details and go, I'll pursue that. I feel very inconsistent sometimes. I'm sort of in awe of how consistent your approach seems from how you describe it now. Do you feel that it's consistent? Or do you, when we cut the recording, will part of you, or, you know, an hour from now or 2 days from now, do you think there's a danger that you'll think, God, I don't know what I'm doing? Like, do you ever have moments of going like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing?
Yeah.
Or do you feel consistent?
I've been having that at the moment.
What a long question. I'm so sorry.
No, totally, man. Like, it's so easy to reflect back on the last decade and be like, yeah, this was the path. And actually going forward is not that clear. But like, for example, at the moment I'm really enjoying the music and I'm making an album and I have a band and we did Glastonbury and basically pretended we were rock stars and it felt really good. And I would, like, that's not consistent and it doesn't follow the trajectory right now. Mm. You know, you've made your first show, right, time to write the next series, maybe get an acting job, to show that you can play other characters. There's a pull in me to do that and I'm really enjoying it and things are building. And then there's this other side of me that's just like, oh no, just go and make an album, you know what I mean? And just do music videos that don't pay. The music doesn't pay. But I also don't want to ignore that instinct as well, because that's the same instinct that ended up, meant that I've ended up doing quite an interesting mixture of things that make me unique. So, I don't know. I'm always trying to balance between, this is the trajectory, And this is what's really exciting you, so don't ignore that. And sometimes they feed each other.
So when you... Tell me about the first time you set foot on a stand-up stage and about how you felt about that, what the kind of lead into that was, whether it was something like, this is a part of, I'm going to need to know how to do this, or whether it was like, screw everything else, I've got to do this. How did you bring yourself to it?
Yeah, it was like, if I could be good at just one thing, it would be that, like, maybe I saw like Simon Amstel live or something, and I was like, oh my God, he's commanding a room. That's so much power. And it was such a nice antidote to the YouTube videos, where I could kind of play it safe and hide behind the camera. And I did start seeing that actually some of it was really contrived. Like, I see a video I did like 8 months ago and I'd be like, oh, I don't talk like that. What's going on? Oh, and I'm just, you know? And so I was just like, let me figure out who I really am with a room full of people, unfiltered and honest. And so I did a stand-up course, because again, it was that thing of like, choose my own curriculum, right? I need to do a course to get the thing.
Okay. Which course did you do?
The comedy school. In Camden?
I don't think I know that one. Okay.
With Mr. C. And so we had our showcase, but it was like the first time everyone's going to do their stand-up. But I was like, well, let me just quickly do a gig before that showcase so I could be the best at the showcase.
I love the idea you would turn up and find everyone else from the showcase also at that
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I did the Lions Den in Leicester Square, and I paid £4 to go on. And it was just like seven of the other comics. And it was, I just got such a buzz. I was like, that was the best feeling ever. And then I did the showcase and it went really well. And I was like, oh my God, this is my calling. I'm a star. I'm Simon Amstel. This is incredible. And then obviously the very next gig, you're like, oh no, I'm shit. Like, and then the gig after that, oh, I'm really shit. Oh, and then a string of shit gigs. And then a comedian friend's booked to one. Like, you know, you're like, oh, maybe this isn't for me. But then a comedian friend had booked a thing and he was like, I'm driving to Brighton, we're doing a gig. And then that one went all right. So it was enough to hang on a bit longer. And, yeah, and next thing you know, you've done six Edinburghs and you're on that conveyor belt.
And you, what were you talking about in the early days? Because I'm really interested in how your stand-up sets, or certainly the sets that I've seen, the televised sets I've seen, have fed into Juice as like an autobiographical or semi-autobiographical kind of piece.
Yeah,
like,
I'd say Juice is
The one that really hit me was the tummy, letting your tummy go.
Yeah, yeah,
like, that's
yeah,
such a lovely moment in Juice. Yeah. And it's a great moment on stage. And I was like, oh, hang on a minute. Oh, wait a minute. That's how that's built. So, but what were you talking about in the beginning, and when did you start talking about reality?
Yeah, I've always lied as well. I think that's quite an important, honest thing to say. I've always, you know, I've always lied in stand up as well as told the truth, because I think that's quite important. So you know, a lot of Juice is fictional, and I'm really glad it is, because it's a really exposing thing to do, to have your own show, to have your family in it. So I'm really glad I had the stand-up stuff that did go into it, that it wasn't all just really... Because watching someone like Simon Amstel, I was like, oh, I'm going to have to say all the most uncomfortable things. But then also you find ways of coding it, you find ways of protecting yourself. Mm-hmm. But the early stuff was really bad, man. It was really bad. I'm too embarrassed to say. It was just like really like stereotypical cliche shit. A lot of Asian stuff, South Asian stuff, about my mom and my family and like... And sperm, doing a sperm donor thing that I didn't even do. I just thought sperm was funny, so I said it. Really bad, man.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So this is Muan. He's a joy. He's a sparkling gem. He's just one of those people who's like, you feel, when you talk to him, you just feel like suddenly you're in his orbit. He's wonderful. Coming up in the second half, we're going to be asking whether you can be mentally healthy and still do comedy. We're going to talk about Muan's dream project, find out what he's working on at the minute, and we're going to ask, of course, if he's happy. Now, I've got some important news for you. The Insiders Club is moving to Patreon. Here is why. You are going to get full video episodes when you join the Insiders Club via Patreon. Full video episodes of every episode we do. You are going to get the extra content now in video as well as audio. That includes, in this case, over 20 minutes of Muan. We have got streamlined account management. We've got exclusive guest announcements and engagement. And we've got new membership offerings, including a monthly Zoom Q&A, which is a Q&A with me with a fun title. You also get access, of course, to the full back catalogue of extras with the new RSS feed. And that is hundreds of hours of stuff. So thank you, as always, for your support. It means that the show can continue to new and greater heights. This change has been in the works for a while now that I'm working with co-producer Callum on the show. I should call him producer Callum, but basically it's a wider kind of, he's co-producing my entire life, really. So I'm going to make a decision now. I'm calling you producer Callum. All right. For me, it was an upgrade that you be called co-producer Callum, but that's just the way that my mind works. From you being the producer of ComCom Pod to the co-producer of my life. This could have been a phone call. But the point is, me and producer Callum have been, we've been working on this change for a few months now. It's so exciting. All the possibilities that are opening up, everything is becoming streamlined and in one place and much, much simpler and much, much better with more stuff in it. Already in the can are full video episodes with Dara O'Brien returning to the show by request, Josh Pugh, Leo Reich, and many, many more. What you need to do now is this. If you're a member of the Insiders Club currently, you need to cancel your current Insiders membership at allsound.com/insidersclub or PayPal, whichever way you've done it, or Moonclerk, the six of you have been paying on Moonclerk. And you need to set up your new membership, which is from £3 a month, at patreon.com/comcompod. The old link of comedianscomedian.com/insiders also works, so you may as well use that. In your welcome email from Patreon will be the new unique RSS feed link, which you can then paste to your podcast app. And from Tuesday the 30th of April, the original Insiders RSS feed will stop updating with new content. The Insiders Club has been £2 a month basic rate since 2015, and I love you. The main podcast is and will always remain free. Right? That's the business. That's what you need to do. Cancel your current membership and rejoin at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Or you, if you're a Patreon person already, you can go direct to patreon.com/comcompod. £3 a month, loads more stuff, loads more good stuff. And this is the beginning of the very first few public steps of a big radical transformation of how I do this podcast. Really, really exciting. I hope you will join me on this glorious next step of the journey. Thank you for listening. We're going to get back to Muan just now. You can follow him on Instagram and Twitter at MuanR. You can watch all episodes of Juice on the BBC iPlayer to find out what we're talking about. And you can see my award-winning climate show, Spoilers, at Leicester Comedy Festival on the 22nd of February and indeed on May the 4th at the McCunliffe Comedy Festival. All of the links in the blurbs and the bio. Let's get back to Muan.
Was that employment of material that you know you're better than, was that out of desperation? Was it just because it was the first idea?
It's first pancake, very wobbly, do you know what
that's
I mean?
A lovely expression. Yeah. I made pancakes recently, of course why is the first one always shit? Every time, right? Like, I'm gonna nail this first one because the mix is the same mix and the pan is right. The same pan,
right?
So why doesn't it work?
You just need to get that first one out of the way and don't give it to anyone, you know, and if you don't put it up on YouTube for eternity. And my first pancake when stand-up was really like lasted 5-6 years, you know. It took me a long time to drop that hack stuff. I don't know why. I think I was really intelligent in terms of like my like ambitions and stuff, but I wasn't that intelligent in terms of writing, and that's okay. Like, but I just always was deluded enough to still do it because at the time I didn't know it was bad. Mm. And if I did, I'd do that thing where a lot of creatives do, which is it's not good enough, I'm not putting it out. It's not good enough, I'm not putting it out. I'd put songs out. I'd always just send energy out, and if it was shit, it was shit. Whatever. I would learn over the course of a year. People don't laugh at that story, Muan. Why? Let's start interrogating it. Stop saying the same old shit. So that happened, but it took a very long time. I see stand-ups now, they've been going for a year. I did the BBC New Comedy Awards, I was judging the thing, and I was like, these people were so good. Yeah, and right. It blew my mind, man. It made me feel really hopeless. It's taken me such a long time to not be shit.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with the concept rather than, yeah, you're right. You were shit, and it has taken ages, yeah.
And even now, well, I'm... but, you know, it's a long journey, man. But I think there's value in taking the scenic route, as I say. There's, you know, the way you age, like a fine wine, like the way you I don't know. Making juice, there were production meetings where I was like, nah, I know my shit. You can't...
It's such an auteur kind of a project, right? I really feel like you made all the decisions on that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I had an amazing producer, Hannah Mulder, and the directors, Roscoe Fife, had very similar sensibilities around what made us laugh and the surreal stuff.
Sure, but you weren't approaching it as some comics will. You get your sitcom that you've written and you're excited to get the sitcom.
Yeah.
So then producers or people with opinions on it, I don't mean specifically producers, but everyone's got an opinion. And if you're not careful, it turns into a sort of grey, sludgy version of what you wanted to do.
Exactly.
You're very much like, this is the vision, that's it. Had you like storyboarded it? What were the tools you used to get what the idea in your head was onto the screen?
Well, first of all, my approach to it was that this is the dream project. This is everything I've been building towards, you know, down to the soundtrack, which I made, you know, with the composer. Like, everything was like, no, every skill, every job, every side hustle I've had, all of those skills are going to go into this. This is not just another thing I tick off my comedian trajectory of like, you do the panel shows, you sell your tour tickets, and then you did it, and then you get your sitcom. No, this is the thing. This is what I want to do. I want to write, I want to act, and I want to play characters that are physical and inventive. So that was the first approach. It was like, again, that thing of like, failure is not an option. So I just worked my ass off, man, and I always just, I always basically said, I want to make something that's like nothing else on telly right now. That was my main goal. And it has to feel honest and emotionally truthful, as well as silly and surreal and adventurous. So that was the ammo. And then it was just a case of making sure I was an exec on it, because I've been in development hell, been stuck in production company development loops for years, pitching stuff. And it never got off. And I knew what a bad producer looked and sounded like. I knew what a bad production company...
Can you describe some of those things for me without identifying anyone? Like the tropes of...
Well, the first thing...
What you look out for?
I was so... This was like my eighth Edinburgh or something like that. And I was so sick of the usual shit. I was like, I'm not trying to make any old TV show. I don't want to make a TV show unless it's on my terms anymore. I'm done. So I was like, the first filtering process was that if they haven't come to the Edinburgh show, they're not getting a meeting.
Yeah.
Because that's a production who's jumping on the bandwagon. Why didn't you come to the show?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They've heard a buzz and they do. So, and then the other, there was also just, you just know when there is a, you know, you do a meeting and it's always the guy and it's always the older white guy who's the CEO and you're giving real like two holiday homes kind of vibe. And he's doing all the talking. And he's got a person of color in the meeting, and maybe a woman, but she doesn't get to speak.
Okay, is that a thing? Is that feel like those people have been invited into the space in order to meet with you, or in order to kind of, like, they're not the boss. They're on the team, but they're not the boss.
You can really feel it when it's like, you can really feel that. I mean, that's super cynical, but I have felt that often. And then you can also feel it when you know that this is a company who works with people for the right reasons. It's collaborative, not just trying to stay on the trendy thing. And then just from the way they talk, you know when they want you to make something because it's exciting and something a bit different, or when they are like, so Channel 4 is looking for a family thing, BBC is looking for this. We could pitch that. You're like, oh, you are basically a banker in a creative job.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the kind of radar. And also, you know, when you decide, it's like a relationship. When you decide to go with a production company or a producer to make your show, you got to think, like, in 5 years' time, when I'm on set and it's crunch time, are they going to have my back or are they going to throw me under the bus?
Yeah, right.
When the channel is going conform, 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 are they going to play the game and be really like actually sneaky about getting your interesting idea through? Or are they going to double down on what the conformist industry is saying and tell you what you need to do?
Yeah, right.
And the first rule of that is, well, let me be exec on it. Because I know it's all in good faith, but if you're not exec, you're not in the room when that final decision is made.
Okay.
So first of all, put your money where your mouth is. And if it's my first, you know, I'm really wet behind the ears, first thing, fine. But I've been doing this long enough to know what I want and the kind of show I want to make. So that was a big thing of like, make me an exec.
When I saw your Apollo set, is it just the once you've done Apollo?
Mm-hmm.
So your Apollo set. When I saw that, I knew, like, it's so well written. I don't mean the individual jokes, but it's such a well-composed set.
Mm.
It's such, how long did you do? Is it like 15 and they edited it down, or I can't remember?
I think you do 20 and they edit it down to 12 or something like that, yeah.
But you, from the beats of, like, mentioning the song a few times and mentioning the confetti and also setting up who you are, your worldview and everything else, it's like, it's such a kind of, it's such a successful statement of intent. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like to go, oh, well, if I'm doing Apollo, I'll do precisely this and then everyone will know exactly who the fuck I am.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, and I've said some complimentary things to you in the last hour or so that you've been like, oh, that's nice. With this one, you're like, correct.
So bad.
No, not at all, because it's correct, because you were very intentional about making those things.
Yeah.
A little birdie tells me you have a really innate sense of what will work and what won't. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, but that's just experience, isn't it? But I also don't. I still do a lot of throwing stuff at the wall, see what sticks. But the Apollo one, I worked my ass off on that. Because it was the Apollo, man. It was, like, huge. It was, you know, all those years of YouTube and all those years of being like, I'm not really a proper comedian. And then you do Apollo and you're like, no, now's my chance to, like, do what I want to do in the way that I'm going to look back in 10 years and be like, yeah, I did all right.
Yeah.
So I really constructed that. And I really thought about that. And I was like, how do I get across all the, like, joy and the dance and all the, like, physical stuff, as well as saying something that, like, emotionally I agree with, politically I agree with.
Yeah.
Because that's there forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it now and be like, piece of shit, I can make it better. Obviously. You just, that's how you grow, right?
The 10 years. The curse of the growing performance. Yeah. The curse of the artist.
Yeah.
It's not a piece of shit. Oh, it's a piece of shit.
Yeah. But I can look at it and be like, for that time, where I was at, well done. And that's big to say that. In the world where we're constantly putting out content and, you know, quantity over quality vibes, it's hard to say that about your work. So it's nice to stand by that.
Were you bashing the circuit ever? Have you done, like, were you ever doing Mirth Control gigs and, you know, driving up? Like, obviously tour support, that's kind of like premium circuit. But were you doing kind of, like, hard yards, drive to Falmouth and back kind of stuff?
Yeah, I always did this thing where I had this voice in my head, it was like, tell a fucking joke, mate. Like, this real kind of, like, male thing in British comedy where it's like, you do the hard graft and you do the shit gigs and you drive up and down. And I always felt like I had to do that and you know, and the clubs. But I think I had quite an unhealthy relationship to it because at a certain point, I was just like, I'm not enjoying this. It's making me a worse comedian in terms of sometimes they laugh more when I say reductive shit about certain identities that I don't want to reduce. So I had to really be like, what am I doing here? And then I started seeing it as an athlete who trains, do a bit of high altitude, do a bit of this, do a bit of isolated exercise on this muscle, do this sport, and then you've got a fuller picture. So I was like, I'm going to do those you know, alternative comedian kind of like more loosey-goosey gigs that are a bit more art form based and a bit more like wanky or whatever. And then I'm also going to do a comedy store in you know, up north somewhere. And then I'm also, just to make sure I could do every room, but when it comes down to it, the main thing I'm doing is the rooms that bring me joy.
I think altitude training is such a lovely analogy, because after altitude training, presumably, one's body is totally fucked because you've been altitude training.
Mm.
And maybe the analogous thing there is that after a gig in Southend, let's pick on Ashford in Kent.
Mm.
After a gig in Ashford in Kent, you come off stage thinking, oh, Christ, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I won, but at what cost?
Yeah,
that
right.
kind of feeling. And I suppose that's the same to the, hey, listen, if you're thinking of it as altitude training, then you're not thinking of it as, I've sold out all my principles in order to leave the stage without stuff getting thrown at me.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I can only do a handful of those things as well, because they don't pay. I learned very quickly, live comedy does not pay. To live, yeah. pay rent in London, I can't be going up to, also, I didn't drive, so I was paying, like, 50 quid for the train ticket and getting paid 60 quid. Like, yeah. by the time you've had a sandwich. So a lot of those decisions were made financially as well. And I'd like to think I wasn't too London-centric, because, you know, you want to keep a view on perspective and how different audiences react. But a lot of the times you end up being London-centric as a financial thing as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's why I was like, I need to write scripts, because, yeah, gigs ain't paying.
To what extent was it a financially motivated decision to write scripts because comedy ain't paying? Or what's the relationship between that and, you know, Mwana, age 12, burning desire, got to make my own show?
Well, the problem is that you start writing scripts and you're like, fuck, scripts don't pay either. Oh, acting doesn't pay either. Okay, so you learn everything. Nothing really
what
pays.
What's the bet?
For ages. What? I tell you what pays, doing an episode of Vera and getting royalties for the next 10 years. But, you know, like, yeah, it's weird that some real dumb shit pays that you're just like, why? What? Adverts pay, you know, but you don't want to do it. Like, so it's a really, yeah, that whole money versus what you actually want to create is a real battle still.
As you continue to be more successful and grow, and, you know, your profile, your star rises, presumably the nature of that battle has changed and will continue to change. Like, you might get better paid advert offers. Or, do you know what I mean? Like, or corporate gigs where you think, oh, they know what they're getting, and I'm a famous guy off the telly now, been on Graham Norton, so the rate goes up. So does the nature of the battle change? Or is that not something on your radar at all?
Does the nature of the battle change? Yeah, kind of. Although I think it gets harder in a different way. I think you have to make more, like, morally questionable decisions, because also there are more eyes on you. And actually there is an impact when you do an advert that you really aren't aligned with, in the way that it... Like, ideally, you do all the shit gigs early, all the paid stuff early, but no one wants to give you even the shit stuff then, because no one knows you.
Yeah. Again, something that I have heard of you from someone else is that you, one of your kind of principles is to go towards the love in a room. And I love that. Tell me about that. Like, in terms of, like, I understand that in kind of going towards the laughs. Like, that's a, you know, I did the Dr. Brown clown workshops a long time ago. They're laughing. Go towards that. That brilliant exercise with the chair and the round of applause. Love it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about going towards the love.
Yeah, for years I would always get really hung up about the person with the resting bitch face, right? And so... And then you'd call them out because you're like, I'm calling the truth out in the room. And then it turns out it wasn't the majority truth. And now even the people who are enjoying themselves think they're not meant to be enjoying themselves. So you've, like, turned it sour for no reason. But you're looking out onto an audience. An audience cannot see the audience around them.
Yeah.
So it's so hard to get that around your head. You know what I mean? Like, they can't see what you're seeing. And it's like doing a telly gig where you're like, if you look like you're nailing it, it's probably all right. And it's always worse in your head. Watching recordings back really helped me realize it's always worse in your head.
Yeah.
And no one gives as much of a shit as you do. And also, I think growing up, I was always like, I got okayness and acceptance from obviously diffusing situations, that classic thing, but, like, also just, you know, externally showing that they're okay with me and that I'm safe in a room. And so when you put that into a hyper, like, big stage light on your face and, like, this intense, nerve-wracking situation of being on stage, then suddenly you can go into this really negative vortex of, like, they hate me, they hate me, that guy hated me, he just yawned. Oh, my God, he just texted. Why is she leaving me? And instead of acting from that insecure place, just being like, that woman is... like smiling like it's the best day of her life. That person is sleeping. They feel safe enough to sleep at my show. The Edinburgh Fringe is a slog. They've seen 8 shows a day. Like, yeah, baby, come in and sleep. I'm still getting that ticket price. You know, approaching it from this mentality, which takes a lot of training and rewiring of your brain.
How do you do that training and rewiring? Because I love that. I love all. It reminds me of Rob Broderick, a Banderman, talking about him and his support act doing like a flipped, like a positive roast battle as a warm up before they go on, where they just love bomb each other.
Yeah, I'm
just in love with that. It's great. How do you do that to rewire your brain? How do you remind yourself to do that? You've got to say, this is the new operating procedure. I'm going to do this from now on.
You just keep practicing. Yeah. And then Edinburgh really helps because you're going, you know, you're doing a show every day. And then you're doing gigs and spots. And so the amount of time you walk onto stage, you can actually really, it's like isolating just your biceps and training them, right? You can just really be like, these next four gigs, I'm just going to isolate being really positive and focusing. Even if there's only two people smiling and the rest of them look fucked, I'm just focused on those two people. Because then you're a mirror to that energy, right? So then you kind of just, people often say that I'm like, they find me quite joyful to watch and they feel very relaxed watching me. And that's because I'm actively channeling those energies in the room and then reflecting them back. So some people who operate in the world of, I'm not okay, you're okay. So they're like, the world is fine, I'm fucked, you know. And there's some performers who approach stage like that. And maybe...
don't know where to look, mate.
No, but, and you know, there's comedy in that as well. There's mileage in that, like, you know. There's I'm okay, you're not okay. So you get performers who are really defensive. Yeah. So they're like, okay, you're going to make that face, are you? Okay, you're going to laugh that loudly, are you? And they're like picking at everything and people then just don't feel safe in a room. And then there's people who, like, I try and just be like, I'm a guy, you know, some people, all right. You know, I try and do that. I try and channel that.
Then, so that's the I'm okay, you're okay.
I'm okay, you're okay.
Are there any performers who are, I'm not okay, you're not okay? There probably are, aren't there?
Yeah, but maybe also that's really funny.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
These are all kind of allowable.
They're allowable.
They're allowable premises for a persona, but they're not great as an actual expression of your mental health.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And in my life, I try and operate from a place of I'm okay, you're okay.
Yes. And
sometimes you meet, talk to a person, you're like, nah, you're really not okay, and I'm going to exit the situation. But with an audience, it's interesting because I do think, yeah, it's so... What makes you not okay and what makes you kind of fucked up in your life is also a perfect comedy premise, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's a really weird relationship. That's why we're fucked. Because we are... basically making work and monetizing the most fucked up parts of ourselves.
Well, that brings me to something I think about all the time, which is that if you became completely mentally healthy, would you continue to work in comedy?
Yeah. I hate this thing of like, you gotta be really mentally ill to be successful. You know, and you know, maybe if Adele doesn't have an amazing breakup, she doesn't have an album. But it's, you can also lie. Lie, save yourself. You know,
I just wonder about, like, I suppose for me, it's if you are really mentally healthy, are you still prepared to pay the quite demanding cost of working in comedy? That's, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, exactly. That's
like
very...
if you sort of go, would you like evenings and weekends and holidays with your partner and your friends?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I would like that.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. I talk about this on the show too much these days, but like, I want to spend all my time with my kids.
Yeah.
I will consider every minute not spent with my kids as a minute wasted, even when frequently they don't want to spend any time with me.
Yeah. But you can also, you've spent time with the kids that have led to giving you stories. And there's things that have come out of that you can't predict. So I don't think it's as black and white as like, you have to have a really fucked up life and really mess up your relationships to have a good stand up set, you know? Because also, you're never going to be perfect. You'll always make mistakes. You'll always act from a flawed place, even if you've done loads of therapy. You know, so it'll all be there. It's just how creative you are in finding it in new places in your life.
Have you got a relationship with therapy?
I need to start again. Things are bad, man.
I was just thinking I need to start again. I've had some great time off when I've been like, woo, I've nailed it, never going back.
Yeah.
Burn bridge. And then you're like, where are you? Cellotape together all the ashes of the bridge.
But I think what making this show has been really intense. Because I put a lot of pressure on myself to, you know, I've given it everything. And I realized making a TV show, they don't tell you this, but especially when you're doing it in the way that I've done it in the altered way, it costs a lot. It costs relationships. And if I'm going to do it again, I need to be realistic about how much of me I'm depleting myself of. So it's a really tricky dynamic in relationship when your dreams are coming true, but also dreams coming true are so exhausting and depleting. And you have to really balance between, I've worked really hard to get to this point, But now I really have to be like, what's important, you know? And sometimes you have to be selfish and protect yourself rather than the work.
Yeah, that's hard. How do you talk yourself into that? How do you talk yourself into like that drive to succeed? And then also sometimes the drive to succeed means overcoming the maybe selfishness, maybe laziness, maybe self-preservation and self-care. You're like, the body wants to be lazy. Do you know what I mean? The body wants to stay in bed sometimes, and you're like, no, I've got to work against that. I've got to overcome that in order to do the dreams.
Mm.
And then sometimes you're like, I actually need to. I sometimes find like, in order to succeed in comedy, certainly in the early days, you need to become obsessional. You need to let yourself become obsessional. It seems that's not that's not in tune with the values of this podcast. But I have felt that obsession.
Mm.
I've got to drag myself up. I've got to get out there. I've got to cultivate the sort of hunger that when a gig comes in and it's miles away, you go, nope, I'm training myself to say yes every time and go and do it. When you're, I'm just interested in that battle, really, that you're like, oh, now the dreams have come true and it's exhausting and the body wants to be lazy. The body wants self-care, let's say. The body, the mind, the relationships, they want self-care. How do you decide which instinct to follow? No, this is day one. The dreams are coming true. It's day one. I've got to do it. Versus, I'm exhausted because in real life, it's day 5,000.
Yeah, but it's not just also staying in bed longer and like taking the easier thing. There's also the amount of motivation and work required to put into your profession or what you do is also actually, you know, your relationships need work as well. So that same way that you're like driving to that gig, you got to drive to that couples therapy or drive to that to be like, I need to do the work because I will otherwise just repeat toxic patterns and behavior patterns that I don't have time to work on.
Yeah.
And it will cost me my relationships. And especially as someone who works in a constellation with other people and gets my energy from other people and really like, I'm really starting to learn the more public facing stuff I do, the more I'm valuing like the close relationships around me, like that close 6, 7. Who are they? What are they feeding me? What am I feeding them? Is it balanced? Am I giving them as much as they're giving me? And it's really hard, man. It's really hard to balance it all. Because sometimes I feel really hopeless about it and I'm like, oh my God, have I worked this hard only to realize I got there, I got on that fucking Graham Norton show and I realized I just want to go home and eat a pizza with my boyfriend. And that fills me with dread.
The dread is about the idea that you might have put all the work in to achieve the thing. It's like someone who becomes a CEO and go, now I have $1 billion.
Yeah.
But now I decide that I never really wanted that. I just wanted a dog.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be with my friends.
Yeah.
But it's impossible, or is it possible, to just cut to the dog and the friends? Because you'll never know what it was like to get the $1 billion.
That's it. I never want to be that. You can only be that drama teacher. It's like, oh, I could have been a star. I'd rather be the one that was like, I became a star and it's not real.
You have to be that one because then at least you know. That drives me bananas.
And then you meet people who are somehow juggling it all. I think Simon is a good example. He's someone who's really, you know, valued relationships and done work on himself as well as had a career. And that has involved every now and again not going for that obvious big commercial thing because it would just cost too much. Who else? I think Riz Ahmed's doing a really good job of it. And, you know, I don't know. I can't think of it. But there are people you meet every now and again or you work with and you're like, smashed it, you smashed it. And you just want them to adopt you. You know, you just want... And sometimes I get obsessive when I meet people who are like successful and actually nice and good and care about people. I'm just like, tell me everything. Give me the book. Give me the rule book. And yeah, you just got to work it out, innit?
What's the dream project? Last but one question, penultimate question. Where are you? What's the dream project you'd be doing 20 years from now?
I want to play a wizard.
Yeah, this is what I want. Yeah, like big dreams. Go for it.
I
want
to play a wizard and have magical powers. And have a really big cape and be walking through a castle. Nice. I know that's not a story.
Movie?
Yeah.
Original or adapted IP from comic book or novel?
I don't know, but I'd love to not write it, actually. My back really hurts. I do too many hours in front of that. I would love to just turn up and do a, just, you know, play a character like Wonka. Do you know what I mean? Like, really, like, go to town and all the shit that they wouldn't let me be in for all those years. I've got to show them. You know,
are you happy?
currently I am, because I've just spent 2 hours talking about myself. And I actually really love it. Generally, I'm getting there. Yeah. It's not a fixed state, though, is it? That's the problem. Yeah, man, I'm doing all right, actually. I did all right, despite everything. Yeah.
So that was Mawaan Rizwan. Like I said, in his orbit, he's just a sort of sparkling space gem. And I tell you what, it's worth following his Instagram at Mawaan R, even, like, not even from a comedy perspective, just because what he wears. My God, my son, the Boutros, he basically channels Mawaan's dress sense, and it's a joy to behold. You can watch all the episodes of Juice on the iPlayer. Future Girl's been joining in this as well. But Boutros and Future Girl have both been doing I've Got a New Walk, which you might be familiar as one of Mawaan's early viral hits. It definitely is seeded throughout Juice as well. So have a little check on that and then see if you can get your own children. All you need to do is sing I've Got a New Walk, Got a New Walk several times, and then they do a new walk. It's brilliant. You can catch up with Mawaan at those places. See him on see Juice on the iPlayer. For my own part, Spoilers is going to be at the Leicester Comedy Festival. This is my climate crisis comedy show, which is award-winning. Thank you so very much. Makes a triumphant return to Leicester Comedy Festival on the 22nd of February at 7 p.m. And also, I will be taking Spoilers back to the Macunclath Comedy Festival on the 4th of May in quite a large room. So do jump into the links there, the relevant links, and find tickets for that. Now, I'm just going to remind you, I've told you all about the Patreon. I'm just going to remind you the simple steps. It is from £3 a month on patreon.com/comcompod. You can also go via comedianscomedian.com/insiders. You get full video episode. Extra content is now in video as well as audio, including over 20 more minutes of Mawaan. Streamlined account management, exclusive guest announcements, new membership offerings, including funnily titled Stu and A. That's a monthly Zoom Q&A. And of course, you get the full back catalogue of extras. So cancel your current Insiders membership, if you please, via Orsound, orsound.com/a/insiders-club. I mean, all of this will be in the show notes, but, you know, if you've got an Orsound thing, go to it and cancel it. And then, and also cancel your... Now, this is a thing I never thought I'd say. Cancel your original PayPal payments. Set up your new membership from £3 a month at patreon.com/comcompod, and you get your new unique RSS feed link, which you paste into your podcast app. You have until Tuesday the 30th of April, but why don't you make me proud and jump on and do it now? The original Insiders RSS feed is going to stop updating from Tuesday the 30th of April. That's almost all I need to say. I won't have time for a proper post-amble, but thank you, Mawaan, for coming on the show. Thanks, producer Callum. And thank you as well, as I make this announcement, thank you so much to Mark Moriarty at Orsound, who was working on the back end of the Insiders Club for so, so long. I'm really appreciative of his hard work. And also to producer Nathan, who was with us for so long, through so many episodes, very nearly 10 years. And then I cruelly ended the relationship just before we hit the 10-year mark. But I'm enormously grateful to both of them for all of their hard work, and very excited to be sort of setting forth in this bold new direction with a whole new thing and loads more fun stuff to be announced. So that is all of that. Thank you once again. Susie Lewis did the logs. The music was by Rob Smouton. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. Thanks for listening. If you're still listening to this bit, and it's not even a proper post-amble, but if you are still listening to this bit, you could tweet at me. What would be a fun tweet? No, let's not overuse it. Don't tweet at me. We'll do another one another time. But for now, just shut your face. Unless you've got a direct question, in which case, get in touch. If you're an insider and you're in the Patreon, just pop a little comment under the episode in there. We can have an actual chat. Toodaloo.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.